Okay, picture this. The Midwest, summer of 1892. The air's heavy, sweet, full of that county fair energy, bright colors, carousels, laughter, the smell of peanuts. Families are everywhere. It's like this explosion of joy, a break from the everyday grind. But then something shifts. A silence starts to creep in underneath all that noise. It's not loud, it's quiet. And that quiet, looking back, is just deeply chilling because 12 children vanished that summer from towns where one particular, really unsettling attraction showed up. 12. And this isn't just some campfire story. We're opening a file today looking at the cold, hard details.
Okay, that's a really powerful image to start with. The contrast is stark, but we have to ask, what's the solid proof connecting these disappearances across different towns? 12 is a significant number. Are we absolutely sure these were linked? That it wasn't, say, a series of unrelated tragedies that got woven together later by panic, by fear? That happens, right? We need to be clear about the actual threat. Was it something people could point to, or more like a feeling, a dread that maybe spiraled out of control? Was the fear proportional to the facts on the ground at the time?
That's exactly what we dug into. And the records, the cross-referenced accounts, they paint a picture that's much more disturbing than just a mass panic. What emerges is a pattern. It's subtle, yes, but it points towards a deliberate method, a specific approach that repeats. This isn't just local gossip layered onto tragedies. We're talking documented facts, specific details, a consistent operating procedure across different locations, a shared experience among the victims' families, and crucially, that one common element before they vanished, so that quiet dread. It wasn't just irrational fear. It feels like a consequence of something specific, something that was hard to pin down because it operated just below the surface. The lack of struggle makes it even weirder, you know?
Okay, so not just rumors, but actual threads in the historical record. That leads to the big question, who or what could pull this off? Operating across multiple towns, leaving this kind of subtle devastation, but doing it within the very public space of a county fair. Fairs were community hubs, lots of eyes. How does someone integrate into that, operate, and not immediately set off massive alarms, especially if children are the focus? The fact that adults apparently didn't raise red flags immediately is, well, it's key. Was it incredible deception, or was there some kind of a collective blind spot in these communities, something that just let this happen?
Right, let's get into the figure at the center of this. The sources introduce someone known then simply as Ronald McDonald, a drifter touring these fairs. But forget any modern image, think 1892. He wore this bright, almost luridly red coat, a yellow waistcoat underneath, really stood out, and white gloves, but long ones, extending way up to his elbows, almost natural looking, and the defining feature everyone seemed to note, a painted smile. Not just painted on, but described as being so wide it looked like it was cut into his cheeks, a grotesque parody of joy. This wasn't some friendly clown figure, this was something else, a haunting presence. The look itself feels like a performance designed to both attract and maybe subtly repel.
It's that theatricality that's so striking, isn't it? The bright colors, the extreme smile it screams, "Look at me." It feels like a performer, someone meant to be noticed, maybe even a bit of a charlatan. So how does someone that visually loud, that designed for attention, manage to operate under the radar, especially if the outcome was so sinister? Usually, you'd expect someone involved in something like this to be trying to blend in, not stand out so aggressively. Unless that very theatricality was the disguise. Make yourself seem like a harmless, slightly bizarre part of the fair's scenery rather than a threat. It's counterintuitive, but maybe incredibly effective.
And that's where the method gets chillingly clever. It wasn't just about being flamboyant, it was strategic. His tent, the attraction itself, was called the Happy Meal admission, completely free. But here's the catch: free only for children. Specifically for children. This wasn't a show for everyone. It wasn't trying to pull in families or crowds of adults. It was targeted, laser-focused on kids. The promise of something free, just for them, no parents needed to fear. It's an irresistible lure for a child at a fair, right? Easy access, no barriers. So the bright costume, the whole performance, it wasn't just random eccentricity. It seems like it was a calculated tool to draw in that specific, vulnerable audience while maybe keeping adults at a slight distance, appearing harmless while being incredibly precise.
That precision is disturbing. Free, but only for children. How did he manage that boundary consistently without parents or fair officials getting suspicious or intervening more forcefully? I mean, a free attraction just for kids, that sounds appealing, sure. But shouldn't it also ring some alarm bells, even back then? Stranger danger wasn't an unknown concept. Was the tent set up somewhere out of the way? Or was its placement designed to be visible, but somehow discourage direct adult oversight? And how did this Happy Meal tent, whatever was inside, keep drawing children back if it had this unsettling vibe you're describing? It suggests a real mastery of, well, manipulation. Both of the kids and perhaps the complacency of the adults, exploiting that fair ground trust.
Okay, let's step inside the tent, based on the descriptions we have. It wasn't what you'd expect. The sources consistently describe the lighting as very dim, not totally dark, which might scare kids off immediately, but like a permanent twilight, maybe heavy canvas blocking the sun. It would make things indistinct, hard to see clearly, creates a weird, disorienting atmosphere. And the smell, this is really specific and unsettling. It was this strange mix. You had the sweet smell of bread, like a fresh bun, something comforting. But underneath that, or maybe mixed with it, was a sharp chemical smell. The sources say varnish, industrial, you know, not a food smell, not a fair smell. That combination, sweet and sharp, comforting and chemical, it's a real sensory clash. Design, maybe, to be just subtly wrong, unsettling you on a level you can't quite name.
That choice of smells, the dim light, it really makes you wonder. Was it just a result of using cheap, available materials for a traveling show? Or was it something more calculated, sensory manipulation? Dim light, like you said, disorients. Makes it harder to process what's happening. Maybe makes kids more suggestible. And that smell combination, bread and varnish. It could create a kind of dreamlike, confused state. Lowering defense, maybe. But still, why wouldn't adults notice these things? A persistently dim tent emitting a weird chemical smell. You'd think that would stand out at a bustling fair. It points again to that disturbing lack of scrutiny, or maybe just how well the deception worked.
And inside that tent, the interaction was apparently the same every single time, a ritual. Each child got a small paper box, red, like his coat, and it had the simple yellow emblem brushed onto the side, reinforcing those colors. Inside wasn't candy or a typical fair prize. It was a soft bun plain, simple, and next to it, a slice of cold meat. The sources just say cold meat, nothing more specific, which adds to the unease. There's also a little hand-carved wooden toy. Simple, maybe seemed innocent enough. But the last thing in the box was a small card. And on the card, just four words, eat up, come back tomorrow.
Not a suggestion, really. More like an instruction.
And this exact routine, day after day, it creates this expectation, this obligation to return. It's conditioning.
The contents are so specific. The plain food, the simple toy, they almost project innocence, don't they? Nothing overtly alarming there. But that card, eat up, come back tomorrow. It is a command, isn't it? It shifts the dynamic entirely. This isn't just a gift, it's establishing a pattern. Was it just about getting them to return? Or was there something in the food, the repetition, the standardization? It feels almost clinical, like parts of a machine, not a performance. What was the purpose of that specific combination bun, cold meat, toy, command? Was it meant to create dependency? Or was it part of some larger process we can't even guess at?
And this is where it gets really deeply disturbing. The sources are unanimous about what happened after the kids left the tent. They came out pale and silent. Just silent. No crying, no visible fear like you'd expect if something overtly scary happened. No signs of a struggle. It was an internal change. A visible draining of, well, of life, almost. Their energy gone. Some apparently wouldn't eat for days afterwards, just refused food. Others wouldn't speak at all, like their voices were just switched off. That's the core horror here, isn't it? This profound, visible shift in their being without any obvious cause. The silence itself is terrifying.
Pale, silent, refusing food and speech. That's a very specific set of symptoms, medically, even psychologically. It's baffling for that era. What could cause that? Is it extreme psychological trauma manifesting physically? Some kind of induced state? Or does it go back to the food? Was there something chemical, something pharmacological involved in that happy meal? But the biggest question, the one that's hardest to grasp, is the parents. Seeing your child suddenly become pale, silent, withdrawn, refusing to eat, how do you not raise hell? Did they really dismiss it as tiredness, shyness, simple bug? Mm-hmm. What was going on in 1892 culturally that allowed parents to seemingly overlook such drastic changes? It's almost as disturbing as the children's state itself.
Exactly. And the sources are chillingly clear on this. The parents consistently saw nothing wrong. That's the phrase that appears. They observed these changes, the silence, the pallor, the lack of appetite, and just rationalize it away. It speaks to this almost hypnotic effect, maybe, of the whole setup. The free treat, the harmless entertainer persona, it somehow blinded them to the evidence right in front of them. Maybe it was partly the culture then. Kids are resilient, maybe they thought, or just a deep-seated trust in the fair environment, in seemingly harmless figures. It paints this awful picture of complacency, of people struggling to recognize danger when it doesn't look like the danger they expect. It wasn't a sudden shock. It was this quiet creep, and they just didn't register it until it was too late.
It really highlights the power of denial, doesn't it? Or maybe gradual desensitization. If the changes weren't overnight, but happened slowly, a bit quieter today, a bit paler tomorrow, it's easier to explain away each small step. You normalize the new baseline until the baseline is horrifyingly abnormal, but you've adjusted. Was it kind of mass psychological effect? Where the desire for the fair to be innocent, for this figure to be harmless, was so strong that people actively ignored the warning signs. Because acknowledging the truth was just too terrifying. Is there something profound and uncomfortable about community dynamics and the human tendency to avoid confronting deeply disturbing realities, especially when they involve your own children?
And that's the key, I think. The sources emphasize how that gradual nature, that slow erosion, made it almost invisible. It wasn't a kidnapping with screaming and chasing. It was this quiet draining away.
Yeah.
A child seems withdrawn one day, maybe eats less the next. Easy to dismiss individually. But cumulatively, over days or weeks, it's a profound transformation. Yet, because it lacked that sudden jolt, that undeniable crisis moment, the horror could deepen unnoticed. People adapt. They adjust their expectations. And that's exactly what seems to have happened here. It was a weaponization of normalcy, almost.
Yeah, the idea that the most effective corruption might be the quietest, the most incremental, that's chilling. Eroding from within rather than attacking from without. If the changes were subtle enough and lacked obvious physical signs of harm, you can see how a community, especially one perhaps predisposed to stoicism or trusting public figures, might miss it. It makes you wonder about the broader context of 1892. Was there something specific about that time and place that made them vulnerable to this kind of slow psychological attrition? It really underscores that capacity for cognitive dissonance, ignoring the uncomfortable evidence because the implication is just too unbearable to face. Protecting the illusion of safety over confronting a terrifying reality.
So the summer ends, and the silence isn't temporary anymore. It's permanent. By the end of the fair season, 12 children are gone. Just vanished. No bodies, no ransom notes, no clues. Nothing left behind in the towns where Ronald McDonald's tent had been, except this void. When the authorities finally searched his wagon, and it seems it was quite delayed, they didn't find what you'd expect. No signs of struggle, no kids' belongings, no blood. The wagon was described as basically empty of criminal evidence. That lack of anything conventional is one of the most terrifying parts. It suggests something other than a typical abduction. A disappearance that clean, that complete, it defies logic.
The logistics of making 12 children disappear without a trace, across multiple locations. It's staggering, especially for that time. How thorough could 19th century police work really be? Local constables, limited resources, relying on eyewitnesses and physical evidence? Were they equipped for something like this? Something that didn't fit the usual patterns? Were there any witnesses to his wagon leaving these towns? Anything at all? And why wasn't it pursued more vigorously if there were? The lack of bodies or struggle evidence is profoundly odd if you think of it as just kidnapping or murder. It almost sounds like they just ceased to exist, which takes it beyond crime into something far stranger.
But the wagon wasn't completely empty. This is where it gets even stranger, hinting at his intentions. What the reports do list is very specific. A crate of that bright red paint. A lot of it, apparently. A big roll of the yellow cloth for the waistcoat. And dozens of unused paper boxes. Identical to the ones given out in the Happy Meal tent. This isn't the toolkit of a typical criminal, it feels like. Supplies. Preparation for more. A kit for repeating the ritual, maybe? Or like, he was mass-producing these meals for some purpose. It suggests continuity, not an ending.
Okay, the paint, the cloth, the boxes, what does that signify? If they're just props, maybe he got spooked and abandoned his plans. That could explain the unused boxes. But if those were the only things left, no personal items, no tools of violence, just the materials for the persona and the meal, that's deeply weird. Does it mean the Ronald McDonald identity was just something he put on and could remake anywhere with these supplies? Or are the materials themselves somehow key? The tools of transformation, maybe, not just disguise. The lack of any other personal trace makes it less like a person who committed crimes and more like the persona itself was the entity and these were its essential components. It elevates the mystery.
Right. And hold that image, the red paint, yellow cloth, unused boxes. Because now we jump forward 20 years. It's around 1912. We're in Chicago, big bustling city, center of industry. Advertising is just starting to become this huge force. An advertising company there is looking for a mascot for a new growing restaurant chain. They need something catchy, family friendly. And in their research, digging through old Americana for inspiration, they buy an old fairground poster from that era, from 1892 or so. Oh, a historical curiosity, just a piece of paper. Seemingly random, but acquiring that poster unknowingly connected this modern branding effort directly back to that forgotten summer of horror.
That just sounds too neat, doesn't it? A coincidence that perfect. An ad agency happens to find the one poster that links back to this dark, unresolved story. You have to wonder, was it just a common name back then? A visual similarity they stumbled on? Or just incredibly poor research before launching a brand? which admittedly might have been more common then. I mean, what are the actual odds of adopting the name, the look of something with that kind of horrific backstory, purely by accident? It strains belief. Unless, is there something inherently compelling about that image, that combination of things that drew them in subconsciously, even divorced from the original meaning? It raises really uncomfortable questions about where symbols come from and why they stick.
But the sources are insistent. This wasn't an accident. It wasn't just similar. It was a direct lift, a clear, undeniable inheritance. They kept the name. Ronald McDonald, exactly the same. They kept the colors, the red and the yellow, that specific jarring combination. And they kept the smile. Maybe tweaked it, made it look friendlier, less like a gash, but still that same unnaturally wide, painted grin. It's too specific to be a coincidence. The name, the palette, the core visual element of the smile, it's a direct lineage. They took the visual identity of that terrifying figure and just rebranded it, sanitized it for mass consumption, stripping away the horror.
If that lineage is truly direct, wow, the implication is staggering. It means that true horror, if you just wait long enough, if the context gets lost, it can be repackaged, commodified, made not just acceptable, but beloved. It says so much about collective memory, or maybe collective amnesia, and the sheer power of marketing to overwrite history, to reshape perception entirely. What does it say about us, about society, that an image potentially born from such darkness could become so embedded in everyday life, a symbol of fun and family for millions who have no idea of its alleged origin? It suggests we can forget almost anything, or worse, embrace symbols whose original meanings are horrifying, simply because the branding is effective enough. The power of narrative completely overriding a potentially terrible truth.
And that leaves us with the final, unavoidable, chilling thought. Every single time you've seen that face, recognized that name, those colors ever since, you've been looking at a killer's face.
The past is rarely buried. Sometimes it's just brilliantly remarketed.